The Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Hey, kiddies, it sucks that football season's over, but brand new, exciting development on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. New show, the Andy, Luke, and Rhee Football Machine is kicking off. Pardon the pun. We got Luke Inman of eDraft. He's got his draft prowess and player development side. We got Arif Hassan of Everywhere. He's talking analytics and the thinking man side of the game. And we got me, Andy Carlson, who is also a person. Yeah. Show is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and of course, coldomaha.com/football machine, a part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network, baby. Let's go.
Back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. At Midwest Swing Pod on Twitter. This is episode number 11. You're finding us on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Follow us at Cold Omaha MN. Get all your Minnesota sports needs taken care of there. You can find us on coldomaha.com. Website recently launched here in the last few weeks. Got a lot of crazy good content going up. Got a lot of cool stuff going on. And I'm going to bring in my producer and maestro, Andy Carlson. You can find him on Twitter at Andy Carlson Show. Andy, tell me about this super show that you started.
Well, I'm on about an hour and a half of sleep because, still amped about it. And, basically what is, it's myself and, Arif Hassan, NFL, and, Luke Inman, of course, of eDraft, all got together, and every single week we're recording out of the KQ studios, and we're going to do an hour of Vikings talk and an hour of general NFL talk, every single week, available on iTunes and on, of course, coldomaha.com. I'm really excited. I'm really jacked up, and it's gonna be a passion project.
Me,
as the cliche is.
Me too. Save some listeners for the rest of us, though, because that show's gonna be a cash cow of sorts.
We raise all boats on the COPN. You know that.
Nice. Well, yep. You can help support Cold Omaha. Go to coldomaha.com. Let me see if I got this right here. coldomaha.com/Amazon. And if you are going to shop at Amazon, and let's face it, everybody shops at Amazon. If you go there, it takes you to the Amazon storefront. Literally nothing is different. Even if you have Amazon Prime, even if you've got Amazon Pantry, we get a couple of shekels off of your sale, and it's one easy way for people to help us. So I wanted to get that out. Before we brought our guest in, our guest today from Vice Sports Milwaukee, you've seen him all over the place on baseball Twitter and talking about a number of different social issues, Jack Moore. Jack, how are we doing?
Hey, Brandon, thanks a lot for having me on. I'm doing great today.
Appreciate you finding time today to come on with us. We got a lot of fun stuff to talk about. First of all, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you.
Everybody's out celebrating that and the beginning of the round of 64 NCAA tournament. Are you going to be indulging in that? As a Wisconsin guy, I would imagine. But are you going to be strictly Wisconsin, or are you watching the whole thing?
Oh, I'm going to be watching the whole thing, but yeah, because Wisconsin doesn't play till tomorrow, I won't get too cardiac quite yet.
Yeah,
I mean, I've got the bracket, but only did one, and I only spent about 15 minutes on it. I think there's a really huge law of diminishing returns sort of thing going on with time spent on the bracket. So,
yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Who did you take winning the whole thing?
I got Michigan State. I think Denzel Valentine is just absolutely amazing. I remember him being pretty much a non-factor like 2 years ago. It's just amazing how Michigan State just keeps on pushing out these guys who can do everything, because he reminds me so much of, even though it's not the same body type, Adrian Payne and Draymond Green. They both were these guys who came out and were pretty limited, and then by the end of their careers, they're doing everything. They're putting up triple-doubles. They're passing the ball. They're shooting threes. They're going inside.
Yeah, if Valentine had stayed healthy, I think he would have – maybe he still does have a good chance to be National Player of the Year. But obviously a guy who was a triple-double threat like crazy at the beginning of the season. And that's who I have winning, too. I have them beating, I think, Kansas. Who do you have them beating?
That's what I had, too.
But I have you might be pleased to hear this. I have Wisconsin sneaking through into at least the Sweet 16. I don't think I have them in the Elite Eight, but I can't remember for sure. But they've obviously hit their stride. They've kind of done the opposite of Iowa here down the stretch. Do you have high hopes for Wisconsin as the tournament starts, or are you just going to watch it and, and kind of view it as happy to be there, and whatever happens, happens.
Yeah, I mean, considering the way the season started, I still can't believe that they lost to Western Illinois on opening night.
Well,
that was amazing. But that this team has like eight freshmen, and I think like six of them play significant minutes. So it's not that surprising that they got a lot better as the season went on. After the two Final Four appearances in the last 2 years, they're pretty much playing with house money at this point.
Who's the player
going to the Sweet 16? So.
Oh, nice. Who's the player that's kind of keyed this run, in your opinion? Obviously, you know, a new coach taking over in the middle of the season is not easy. Has there been a specific player who you've had your eye on as far as kind of the instigator of this run?
The player that got a lot better was Vito Brown, who is another one of those classic big Wisconsin guys who he's 6'10". His offensive game really is he's a catch and shoot 3-point shooter, and it's another one of those things where you know, Wisconsin might not have players who can win their individual matchups, but the way that they run their offense, they have a lot of guys who have really weird skill sets for their positions, and if they get the right matchup on the offensive side of the ball, they'll be able to win it. So I like their chances against Pitt in the first round for sure. They were not good down the stretch. Xavier will be a tough second round matchup, but who knows? I mean, Wisconsin, especially the win that they had at Maryland, being the first team to win at Maryland in their whole Big Ten tenure so far, that was a really impressive win, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. I got Maryland doing some big things in the postseason, and so to get that win, I think was obviously big for them. So we're kind of beating around the bush a little bit here. That's my fault. You grew up in Wisconsin, and you kind of mentioned that with Andy at the beginning of the show. Is that where you were born?
Yeah. I grew up by La Crosse, so actually I could see Minnesota from my window. A little bit of the Sarah Palin rhetoric at you.
Yeah.
But I did not treat Minnesota like Russia. So.
Well, good. So Packers, Badgers, Bucks. I mean, it's
yep.
Across the board, all Wisconsin. You know, Brewers, of course. We'll get into that heavily too. But just straight across the board, Wisconsin then?
Yeah, but honestly, I didn't really become a Brewers fan until cable finally reached out to the boonies where I lived. So.
And really, when was that?
That would have been late 90s.
Yeah, and I think you're a little younger than I am, so you would have come to the game as, you know, maybe 10, 12 years old. Is that about right?
Yep. My first baseball game actually was at the Metrodome in person. So,
who'd you see?
I saw the Twins and the Blue Jays.
Any memorable?
Oh God, I was like six. I don't remember anything. The best memory is the air flowing into the Metrodome after they opened up the depressurized doors.
Oh yeah,
that unforgettable.
I think Nomar Garciaparra hit a home run in the first game I ever saw live at the Metrodome, and that was, you know, kind of cool. I mean, a guy that was on a Hall of Fame path and derailed by injuries, but. That was kind of fun. We snuck down to the lower level. We had nosebleed seats, but there was like 8,000 people there. So, you know, we just kind of snuck in and snuck down, and you know, easy to do back in those days. As far as baseball, so what cultivated your love of the game, and who set you on the path to being the fan that you are today?
I have an older brother, my only sibling. He's 11 years older than me, and his high school baseball team went to the state tournament in Wisconsin when I was about 5 years old. And so that really got everything rolling. It was already there at that point, just because my brother had been playing the whole time that I was growing up, and I wanted to be just like him. So that I think would be the start. And then you know, I played Little League all through high school. I played at I went to the University of Wisconsin. I played on their club team, which was a lot of fun. I highly recommend anybody who's in college right now listening to this, check out if there's a club team around, you know, especially because in high school, sometimes you get with the coaches who get just too intense about winning. When you're on a club team, you know that everybody's there because they want to be there. It's really refreshing, and it was by far the most fun sports experience I had playing.
That sounds amazing. I played a year Division III but nothing, you know, nothing of that vein. And that sounds like a lot more fun as far as an experience for cultivating a love for the game, as opposed to, you know, nothing wrong with winning and nothing wrong with that kind of thing too. It's just some people are wired differently and some people are going to, you know, take more enjoyment from a different experience. I would suspect that your love for the game and numbers was probably cultivated a bit by your major at UW. Would that be wrong?
I would say that, I majored in math, and there's always a connection between the two things, because I was a math whiz all through elementary school the whole time that I was growing up with baseball. So, you know, there's always that natural connection between stats and baseball, and that was no different for me, for sure. And, you know, I was pursuing the sort of analytical side of the game as a career before I got totally enamored with writing, and specifically writing about more of the social issues.
When did you become statistically inclined, in the sense that you viewed the game from the lens maybe more of like the sabermetric side of things? You know, like, obviously I grew up watching on MSC before it was Fox Sports North, and it was, you know, home runs and RBIs and batting average and stolen bases and wins and losses for pitchers. And then, you know, for me, it was kind of like I was part of that sabermetric, you know, age that came to the game in that sense, both on forums in like 2004, 2005, and Moneyball, and, you know, reading the prospectus annuals. What was that flip of the switch for you?
Yeah, for sure. In high school, I was really resistant to OPS because stuff like that. Because why would you add that together? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's a bad fraction.
And that, yeah, exactly. And then, like, I thought VORP was just weird.
Well,
and inexplicable. And, you know, now 10 years later, it's like, oh, yeah, that actually was the case. But when I was in college, I started reading FanDraft and Baseball Prospectus pretty heavily, and I started thinking, hey, you know, I can do that. And then I did it.
Isn't that kind of awesome, though? I mean, like, I remember reading the first annual I had was 04, and I remember thinking, man, I'd love to write this stuff. I'd love to be in this book. And then I made the acknowledgments like 4 years later. You know, I helped.
Yeah, Mark for me, Norman. It was FanDrafts was the one where I was like, okay, I want to be on this site.
I helped Mark Normandine with a data project. I'm just like, man, my name in print. This is kind of cool. And then yeah, FanGraphs was after Prospectus for me, but it was like, I really want to be wherever these guys are going, and not necessarily, you know, at that level, because I just don't quite have the math chops that a lot of the guys have, mm-hmm. But. You know, it's nice that there's different niches for everybody else. I mean, not everybody has to be a Dave Cameron. You can have a David Lorilla. You can have a Jeff Sullivan. You can have an August Fagerstrom and do a lot of different things. And you don't have to fit into a neat box. And people will still enjoy your writing.
Yeah, I will say with my experience with math, it's really easy to get down on yourself about not having the, like, kind of calculation skills that – This goes back to the way we teach math, going all the way back to elementary school. And, like, you know, we freak out about people who can do the multiplication test, you know, do 100 sums or 100 times, mm-hmm. you know, in 2 minutes. But that's not what any of this is about. It's more about being able to see the concepts, being able to, you know, understand what's feeding into why these things happen. Computers are doing the calculation. You don't have to worry about not being able to do this if you're, you know, a little bit weak with math. So if you can wrap your head around the concepts, there are tools to help you with the actual numbers.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the most daunting thing is getting past that initial intimidation factor, because at the kind of the crux of it all is that, you know, even the most well-known people make mistakes in their analysis. They make mistakes in their calculations, and you just, you know, those things can be the law for a long time before people go back and reconfigure and like, oh, well, we thought this, but now we think this. And so, you know, it's not a crime to make mistakes. It's not a crime to try and strike out.
Absolutely. You know,
to use obviously a baseball metaphor, but it very poorly placed one, I might add. But it isn't against the rules to try and fail and dust yourself off and try again.
Totally. No, so, I mean, that's the only way we learn.
Yeah, exactly. And so your rap sheet, so to speak, is pretty long.
Yes.
So the places I already mentioned, Fangraphs, Vice Sports, BP Milwaukee. I do want to ask you about BP Milwaukee a little bit. Teams, the team-specific sites, and it sounds like BP is starting a Kansas City one now, too. This is a cool project, and I hope they start a Minnesota one. Mm-hmm. What has gone into that? What is your role with BP Milwaukee, and how have you enjoyed it so far?
I believe my title is senior writer there. Honestly, I'm not sure. We have a little bit of a change of management going there in the future, so
sure.
We'll see what happens. But I've just been writing once weekly, and this off season I've been devoting myself to. I personally wanted to learn a lot about the sort of economics and politics that went into how we treat small markets in baseball. Looking at the last 30 years, how the game turned around from one where, you know, big owners like your Walter O'Malley's in Los Angeles and obviously Steinbrenner in New York, they used to run things. And in the past 30 years, there's been a total upheaval to the point where, you know, obviously Bud Selig is a Milwaukee guy and he's the commissioner. And it's been his coalition, more or less, that has run things in a very significant way for the past, you know, 20 years. And so that's what I've been devoting myself to this offseason at BP Milwaukee is examining that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of Twins fans probably read my article about the Twins and their, what I call their small market con. And that was just a natural outgrowth of the kind of things that I was researching, because I wanted to know, like, how do we get to this point where we really believe that these baseball teams are poor? Because that's ridiculous.
How did your view on the Twins evolve as you researched that? You know, obviously you're going to have preconceived notions when you dive into something, and then it's going to change
right.
as you read and study and write and read and revise. What did you get to in terms of evolution from where you began and where you finished?
Yeah, I was not really expecting there to be such concrete, such obvious corruption, really. I thought there's going to be a lot of, like, you know, manipulation through the media, hitting on a bunch of buzzwords like small market and, you know, talking about salaries and talking about how, you know, Minnesota can't compete financially with teams like the Yankees and blah, blah, blah. And there's plenty of that. But finding the evidence of it was not even buried. It's just in the New York Times of, you know, Bud Selig and Carl Pohlad, giving a $3 million loan to Selig, which, while Selig was commissioner, which is really just blatantly corrupt. And the way that the Pohlads tried to play the people of Minnesota and the government in basically claiming that, you know, we need this money from you and you need us so much that you should just give it to us. And the way that it worked, it was just, it's kind of distressing how much power that these franchises have over us.
Would you say it made your skin crawl?
A little bit, yeah. But what? At the same time, you know, this is going on and it's obvious. I knew about it, but yeah, it's always surprising to me how deep it goes.
What role did contraction and even before that, like the threat of relocation, you know, where Pohlad wanted to move the Twins to that Tri-City, like Winston-Salem area. What right. roles did those play in your research as far as things you learned?
Right. Well, you guys are cold Omaha. And
right.
I learned about the whole cold Omaha thing from Bud Selig sending his lawyers to talk about how without the Twins, Minneapolis would become a cold Omaha, which is so ridiculous when you think about the differences between these two cities. My roommate actually does regular business work in Omaha. And when I mentioned it to him, he thought it was absolutely ridiculous of a comparison, considering the difference in size and how many more things are here in the Twin Cities. So, but there's a lot of insecurity in especially Midwestern cities, and Milwaukee is the same way, about, you know, being important. And the Selig and the Pohlads, they were really able to seize on that kind of anxiety that, you know, we have that across the Midwest. We don't want to be thought of as flyover country. We we're real people. We're important too. So, and it's, you know, I think it's wrong that they will seize on such basic things like that.
To what extent did the Metrodome truly affect things for the Twins, you know, versus maybe what fans were told, you know, can't compete until you get outside, that kind of thing? I mean, did it play at least some sort of role, or was that mostly a completely made up narrative?
I mean, I think that was real, because when you look at the way the Twins have been able to draw, I think it's like something like 2.5 million fans to Target Field, even with the team being awful in the previous years. Like that's pretty significant. That means that they can maintain a solid payroll with people continually coming to the ballpark. That means they can maintain a payroll even if the team's awful for a long time in a row. And they were not even bringing in 2 million fans to the Metrodome in years where they were okay. So yeah, it was a significant deal. The thing that I took issue with was the idea that the Poleds needed to be given $350 million in public money to make it happen.
Right.
The Poleds could have built a new stadium years before they built Target Field, and this would have been a great business decision for them. It's not like, you know, it's not like I'm saying they needed to build a new stadium as, you know, some kind of like public tribute or whatever. It would have been great for them. They were just, you know, holding out for the money because they could.
When it comes to payroll, is, you know, my theory without doing any research, and so you, I would love for you to squash this narrative if you are able, is that it maybe wasn't necessarily to build the stadium to become like the Yankees or even the Cubs, where you go out and you know, just kind of put your cards on the table free agency wise, but to be able to keep your stars at home, you know, to keep your Joe Mauers, Byron Buxtons, Miguel Sanos, assuming they develop like they're supposed to. And then, you know, still being active on the free agent market, but I don't think that it was ever going to be that they were going to land a, you know, a 10-year, $200 million guy on the market. Is that foolish to think, or was Target Field the kind of thing that should get them to the middle of the pack payroll-wise, or should they be near the top?
Yeah, no, they're clearly a mid-market team at most, and it was pointed out to me by Colin Wires, who used to work for Baseball Prospectus.
That's a guy you do not want to argue with. He's very smart.
Yeah, no, he's brilliant, and he pointed out that they're, you know, using the strict the media market numbers that I was using is not perfect, because for example, if you look at the Cincinnati Reds, who are in a tiny market, they pull in from bigger cities like Columbus that are nearby, whereas Minneapolis is far more isolated geographically than most major league cities, you know, on the East especially. So, yeah, I don't think there's any reason to believe that the Twins will ever be this kind of team that's going to go out and have a free agent signing blitz. But, yeah, they should be able, and especially with the way that the free agent market works right now, there just aren't that many guys out there on a yearly basis who want that anymore. Most guys are being signed up by their hometown teams at this point, the big 10-year deals while a guy still has 2 years of arbitration left, something like that. And, yeah, that's what Target Field should be able to do. Like, Twins fans should be mad if the next Joe Mauer, or, you know, hopefully it's Buxton, right, or Sano or somebody like that.
Yep.
They should be mad if a guy like that gets away. They shouldn't be able to cry poor on that. Like, you shouldn't be expecting them to go out and sign every free agent, of course.
So that would seem to benefit the Twins, you know, this dynamic that you're putting out there of draft, develop, and keep. That should seem to benefit the Twins, because that's kind of been their MO from the get-go, even in the poor, quote-unquote, poor days.
Right.
They should benefit them from not having to change too much, because the free agent market is becoming more and more bare in terms of quantity, maybe not necessarily always quality. You know, that could change this next offseason with guys like Steven Strasburg hitting the market. But I would think that the Twins Cardinals kind of approach there would probably be the way to go then.
Yeah, it's the only way to go, I think. I think really there's a lot of things in the financial system of baseball that discourages free agent spending. That was one of the things that I found in my research. There's basically the way the revenue sharing and luxury tax systems work is to make the value of a dollar on the free agent market significantly less. And so what does that mean? It means you have to go somewhere else to acquire your talent. And especially because now that Major League Baseball is putting significant limits on international free agent spending,
Right.
You don't have that advantage anymore. So unless, of course, you're the Yankees and you just don't care about the spending tax that they put on. It's ironic, I think.
Well, and they've rolled back in the last couple of years. Now they've been, weren't they the only team in the entire big leagues that didn't bring in an outside free agent this offseason?
Right, right, yeah.
So it's so weird how it's a bizarre world out there in free agent market.
They didn't do that. They went and they blew like 10 times over the amateur spending limit the year before in the international market. So, and also with hard slots in the draft. So you're not going to be able to get advantages by spending money to get a guy that you want at a spot that you wouldn't be able to get him otherwise. So what's going to be even more important than drafting, I think, is going to be development and coaching. And yeah, when you look at those Twins teams back in the early 2000s when they weren't spending any money and they were still winning because they were just constantly graduating really good players to the majors. Yeah, if they're still good at that, that's going to be great for them.
You mentioned draft slotting. What is your take? You know, I know draft slot and the, you know, bringing down the value of amateur players is a hotly contested issue. Mm-hmm. What's your take on teams with higher picks going lower slot guys to, you know, let's say you got pick one and pick 38, but you get two, say, like the number 14 talent and the number 15 talent because you've kind of, you know, rigged it up so you can pay equal balances to the two picks. Do you think that's a good way to work the system, or do you prefer that teams don't do that kind of thing?
Oh, I mean, they give you the pool money is the big thing right now, rather than specifically what spot you pick a guy in, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, if you see an advantage, or you can get a guy, like, specifically, I think where that can work is if you have a guy in high school who has a really solid, you know, college scholarship offer.
I think Daz Cameron was that kind of guy.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's a place where a team can really, you know, pick up some arbitrage value, if you will, through spending to get one of those guys. But the way the spending limits have been enacted, I really think that it's put a significant limit on how creative teams can get. And when you put limits on how creative teams can get, it just goes back to the money.
Yeah. So outside of baseball things, you have also done Hardball Times and some BP stuff on the main site. You've done things with The Guardian, recently in The Atlantic. How do you say this V1? Because I don't know how to say it.
Vocative. It's like provocative.
Got it. So
yeah, I asked them about that one too.
what have been the key issues you've been focusing on lately? I know I've obviously been following closely on you with football stuff. In fact,
yes.
I had tweeted you. I was on the treadmill a few months back watching a replay of the Super Bowl of the Broncos and the Packers, and Terrell Davis was on the sidelines, and it's a little bit of foreshadowing based on how we know his career ended, that it said, I was watching the closed captioning, it said, Terrell Davis has a little bit of the concussion, he's probable to return.
Right.
And even just 17, 18 years ago, let alone maybe even 10, 12, that's how brain issues were viewed, was just, yep, you know, rub some dirt on it, you know, smelling salts, whatever. What other issues in addition to that have you been working on?
Yeah, so my Atlantic piece was about the burgeoning football helmet market and how there's a lot of people out there who think that they'll be able to protect themselves from concussions with the proper equipment, and there is absolutely no evidence that this is true. The crux of my piece was that these helmet manufacturers are doing anything that they can to market the fact that they're safe. And that has led to a bunch of really flawed studies, specifically this one conducted by Virginia Tech. These football helmets, they have star ratings from Virginia Tech. And if a helmet gets 5 stars, basically if it doesn't get 5 stars, it won't sell anymore. And if it tops the list, it will be one of the top sellers. It's a really great predictor of how a helmet's going to sell. All they do is they take the helmet and they drop it onto a sensor and they measure the impact, and then they do it at horizontal angles and then they do it up instead of down. So it only measures the linear force. They added what actually causes concussions is not generally straight line force. Like if a boxer gets punched straight on in the middle of the forehead and his neck goes straight back, that's the kind of thing that the body can handle.
Mm-hmm.
But if what really hurts is when you get kind of clocked in the side and there's this spinning and rotational acceleration. And that was not accounted for at all in this Virginia Tech study. And when you look at, there's a helmet that came out recently called the Riddell SpeedFlex. And it has this little crumple zone area basically on the top of the head. You've probably seen guys wearing this helmet. It has a little like pentagon sort of panel that like sticks out on the top, on the crown of the helmet. And if you look at the way they test these helmets, that little crumple zone is right where the helmet hits the sensor bar. And so they're clearly just gaming the test to get good numbers. And so 2 years later, 2 years since that, it's been 2 years since that helmet came out. And there was another study done by the NFL and the NFL Players Association that did include the rotational acceleration, and that helmet finished in the middle of the pack. So 2 years, and already this helmet that we thought was the pinnacle of safety is like, oh, the data was just totally wrong. Whoops. Sorry if you paid the $100 premium for this safety helmet. And so, football, people are going to have to make their own decisions as to whether or not they want to play football. Well, what really disturbs me about the game and, you know, the NFL, but also, you know, people who are boosting the game at every level, we're not getting the whole story here. People are desperate to be told that the game that they love is safe. And there are a lot of hucksters out there that are willing to say, yeah, here's this. Go out there, go play, don't think about it. And that's gross. I think it's disgusting.
Well, what you're saying about concussions makes a lot of sense. You know, Justin Morneau's concussion that basically derailed his career. You watch it and he slides into, I believe it's John McDonald of the Blue Jays back in 2010. And mm-hmm. It's just a glancing blow off the side of the head. But, you know, he turns his neck.
Right.
And so the things that you're seeing add up. It doesn't look like a crucial, critical blow, but he catches, you know, whether it's the thigh or the knee just right. And, you know, basically his career is over. I mean, you know, he did have a few moments here or there, but he was an MVP caliber player before that, and he was a shell of himself after. And so it's not, you know, it makes sense. So basically what you're saying, though, with these helmets, it's just creating the illusion of safety.
Absolutely.
And basically, as an American public, that's enough for most of us to be like, yeah, all I need is to be told that it's safe. I don't need proof. I don't need concrete, legitimate proof. I just need to be told what to do.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I don't want to be, I don't want to say that people who play football or let their kids play football are bad, because I think there's so much social pressure in America. For, you know, there's pressure on the kids to play football. There's pressure on the parents to have their kids play football for what it means, especially, you know, I grew up in a small town. I know what it's like to live somewhere where the high school football game on Friday is the big event.
Well, there's nothing else to do for a lot of those kids.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not so easy as just saying, hey, this is dangerous. You got to stop playing. Like we have to confront this culture, and we have to. There has to be a reckoning with what's going on, and I think there's going to be a huge public health problem with CTE, and I think, you know, we didn't start using the hard shell plastic helmets until the 1970s. I think that those helmets, they give players the illusion of safety, like I was talking about. They let you think that you're invincible. They let you think that you can lead with your head and be fine, but you can't. And all those hits are piling up in a way that probably weren't even for players who played, you know, back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s.
The leatherhead era, basically.
Right? If you were, especially without the metal face mask, that's actually one thing that I've seen from doctors going back to the 70s. The metal face mask is actually the biggest issue. Because without that, you don't lead with your face. Like, I mean, it's pretty obvious, right? If you're worried about getting a broken nose, you're not going to throw your face at some other guy's you know, chest to make a tackle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's just going to get worse. And I think with the you know, we're going to see a lot of people getting addicted to painkillers and then doing all, you know, all of a sudden they're not themselves. And we're going to be like, oh, what's going on? It's a public health issue. Public health, I would go as far as to say crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to do something about it.
So it's taken away, though. I mean, it's taken away the concept of self-preservation when it comes to football. As the person delivering the hit, you know, obviously there's an element of self-preservation if you are an offensive lineman and you are protecting the quarterback, but it's taken away that sheath of self-protection or self-preservation in that you care about your head less than you really ought to when you're making these plays.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay, that makes sense. And so before we move on to other stuff, I do want to ask, what do you think of the MLB pitcher helmets that they've been testing out and how those have evolved from, you know, the great gazoo-looking cap that Alex Torres was kind of infamous for wearing to this kind of shell that they're looking at now? You know, obviously not as much of a hot-button issue because baseball is, I think, believed to be and probably quite frankly is a lot safer than football. Do you still think these pitcher protective caps are moving in the right direction?
Yeah, and you know, as much as safety is important, realistically, you're not going to get something to catch on until you can fix the aesthetic part of it.
Like,
and I laughed every time I saw Alex Torres, and I know it's wrong, and I know you shouldn't laugh at a guy for doing safety things.
Right.
But I was actually looking up, you know, stories about hockey helmets in the 70s, and you know, you have kids. A kid who quit playing hockey rather than when his mom said, you need to wear a helmet or I'm not going to allow you to play anymore. And the kid quit rather than wear a helmet. And so, yeah, you know, you're going to have to make it something that athletes are okay with doing. And I think the new stuff looks significantly better.
Yeah,
so,
I think they're...
So they're moving in the right direction, and it does seem like they're taking player input and incorporating that, and that's important. And
Yeah, you got to get the players behind it. The people that are going to use the product need to endorse it, not necessarily from an endorsement standpoint, but from a this-works-for-me standpoint. Let's do this. Let's dive into a little bit of Brewers talk here. I do have to do one thing first, though. Ticket King is a great sponsor of Cold Omaha. We've got a deal going with them where if you use the promo code COLD, as in Cold Omaha, you save $10 off a purchase of $100 or more. They have tickets to all the major sports events in town, your Twins games, your Timberwolves games. Timberwolves have been hot lately. I know Jack has gone to a few of those games. Wild games, hopefully they can pick it up and get into the playoffs here, steal one of those last two spots. You know, some of the hotter tickets in town. Start thinking about that new stadium. I know that they got a Metallica concert coming up here that's going to be pretty awesome. But you start thinking about all those things, about Vikings games and all that things. All those kind of things. TicketKingOnline.com, promo code COLD. You can get concert and theater tickets in the Twin Cities and no fees, unlike the other big ticket brokers. So check out TicketKingOnline.com. Jack, the Brewers are obviously tell me if I'm wrong here. I would call it a rebuild. I don't think it's necessarily a retool, but would your opinion differ from that?
No, they're going to be bad this year.
Okay. And so... The reason I had some trepidation in calling it that is that they still have Jonathan Lucroy, again, a very good player, don't get me wrong, Will Smith, another very good player, and Ryan Braun, who's in a weird spot where he's got, I think he's still got a few years left on his deal, like quite a bit of money.
Oh, yeah, and, he's signed through 2020.
Yeah, so, you know, the Twins rebuild with Joe Mauer. It's not impossible to have a guy on a long deal and rebuild. But, you know, it's just, it does throw, I think, some unique wrinkles into it. Do you think it's a full-on rebuild, though?
Yeah, I do. I expect Lucroy to be traded by the deadline. And,
okay.
I think they would trade Braun if anybody would give, you know, reasonable value for him. But I don't think there's any way you trade Ryan Braun, given the steroid stuff, given his injury problems. Actually, I think that's actually the bigger issue, considering how much money is left on his deal.
Right.
You know, you combine those three things, and you have a player who's still really good, but is almost certainly not going to bring you much value in return. And so, yeah, it would be great if they could trade Ryan Braun and get something back in return for him. But I have to think that even with how old he is, I think he's 32 this year.
Mm-hmm.
I still have to think that a 35-year-old Ryan Braun in 2019 is probably more value than what they're going to get back for him.
Yeah,
and, like I also don't think that they're going to get much in salary relief if they were to trade him. So
like a B minus prospect, B plus prospect that might not make it.
You take a chance on a live low A arm. Nah, I'll take a chance at the guy who hit. You know, he had I think he had a 900 OPS in the last 5 months of the season last year. I'll take a chance on that guy still being good.
And so you think there's a non-zero chance he can help the next decent to good Brewers team, whether that's 1 year from now, 2 years from now, 4 years from now?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. We had this discussion with Eno Saris last week about the Reds, incidentally, another NL Central team, and Joey Votto. Again, Votto, I don't know. His contract is much worse than Braun's from a slogging standpoint. But I don't know where he's at in his aging curve compared to Braun. You know, I think they're both probably on the downside, so to speak, and I don't think that's too controversial. But it's going to be interesting to see where those guys are when those teams get good again. I think the Reds are on a little bit faster track with their rotation, and we'll talk about the Brewers' rotation too. But it'll be fun to see how both of those guys age with the teams around them. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think Votto is much better and has less baggage, and that the Reds probably could get something worthwhile for him if they floated him in a deal, especially if you get a situation where you have a team at the deadline that really, really needs a slugger at some point in the next couple of years. But yeah, it's a really similar situation. The Reds roster is absolute garbage this year. I think it's actually worse than the Brewers.
Yeah, it might be. I like just a couple guys, Raisel Iglesias. They got a couple interesting pitchers, but no, it's not going to be pretty. And it's not particularly cheap either with Brandon Phillips and Jim Bruce either. So it's a weird spot. I think if they could unload Bruce and unload Phillips, you know, Phillips has got 10-5, right? So he's not going anywhere. But, you know, he could change his tune at the break if they're struggling and someone needs a second baseman. But it's a weird spot to be in. What are your expectations for this year's Brewers? I mean, they're not going to lose 100 games or anything, are they?
No, I don't think so. I think they'll be in that 70 to 75 win range. But they don't have a chance to contend with how good the NL Central is. I mean, you look at the Pirates, who I think are – I don't think they're going to make the playoffs this year. But
that's a really good team too.
Yeah, but they're still good. A lot more holes on their roster than recent years, though. Mm-hmm. Starting to see the effects of guys like McCutchen getting expensive. But then you obviously have the Cubs and Cardinals, who are both going to be World Series contenders. So
there's going to be anywhere from two or three really good National League teams sitting at home in October. When you think about, you know, I think everybody loves the Cubs. I think people like the Pirates. I think people really like the Cardinals. Mm-hmm. But you know, in the East, you know the Mets are going to be good. The Nationals have the pieces to be good, and then you have out west, you got the Dodgers. If they have enough arms to field a full rotation, should be good. The Giants, you know, everybody talks about that even year magic, but they went out and really addressed not only that rotation, but Denard Span out in center. They've always seemed to be right there. It does leave me thinking, what in the heck are the Marlins doing, and what in the heck are the Rockies doing? The two 1993 expansion teams that have not gone in on this rebuild. You know, you could say the Rockies have by trading Tulo, but they got back Jose Reyes.
Yeah, that's not a rebuilding move. That's a lateral move. It was weird.
And you got Reyes, who's an absolute train wreck of a human being.
Right.
And you still have Carlos Gonzalez. You signed Gerardo Parra for some reason. They traded the outfielder, Blackman. Is that right? Charlie Blackman?
They traded Dickerson.
Dickerson. Oh, yeah. I always get those two mixed up.
Right.
And so it just – what in the heck – I can't really figure out what the Marlins and the Rockies are doing. I don't think either of those teams have a prayer.
No, I don't either. And the Rockies have – they have no direction, and they haven't had one for years. And the Marlins – I mean, do they even try?
Yeah, you go out and sign, you know, Wei Yin Chen to a pretty big deal, but it's just like I don't get it, and you know, I'm kind of derailing us from the point here of you know, the Brewers are rebuilding, but there are still, in addition to the teams that are rebuilding, I feel like there are more who should be rebuilding. It's funny to me though how literally, and feel free to disagree if you see otherwise, every rebuilding team to me right now is in the National League.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the way it looks. I think the Brewers are at least moving in the right direction, and I also do appreciate how they filled their huge holes. Mm-hmm. Like in the Gene Segura trade, they got back Aaron Hill, who obviously is not going to be a part of the next contending Brewers team. The Brewers didn't have a third baseman, and I think you can really – I don't think it's helpful to have a really bad player who obviously has no future on the team, because the Brewers have no third base prospects at this point. Yeah. I don't think it's helpful to have a totally empty roster spot like that. So you play Hill there, you see if he does something, you can trade him. If not, whatever, you go on with it.
Yeah, you're sunk in one form or fashion either way, but you're not going to force a round peg into a square slot, so to speak.
Yeah, they did the same thing with signing Chris Carter to play first base. It's
a
placeholder who they can use, maybe can flip.
Do you think there's any chance that he just absolutely mashes, you know, like hits maybe 220, takes a few walks, and hits like 30 bombs?
Yeah, Milwaukee is the perfect park for him because right. both the corners are tiny. And yep. I could see him just hitting a bunch of really, you know, those kind of, you see the right fielder jogging back like he's going to make an easy catch, and then he runs into the wall, and it's like, how was that a home run?
So if you're going to be bad, at least be entertaining?
Yeah, yep.
Is that like, okay, so you said you came up watching the late 90s Brewers. For whatever reason, I remember them being entertaining, even if they weren't very good.
They were so bad.
But wasn't it like the Jeff Jenkins era?
Jeff Jenkins, absolutely.
Was Brian Giles on any of those teams? I can't remember.
No, Jeremy Burnitz.
I always get those two confused.
The other fun masher, yeah.
Yep. The I believe he was an outfielder. Did he swing left-handed?
Uh-huh. Yep.
And I always
Richie Sexton was my favorite player.
I grew up watching.
I was number 11 for him.
The Mashers. I grew up watching John Jaha and Greg Vaughn.
Right. Yeah.
As the guys
similar
before
kind of
the,
thing.
But you know, it goes all the way back.
Breaking the single season strikeout record multiple years in a row.
I think he's since passed too, hasn't he?
Not sure.
I believe he did. Well, anyway, the Brewers have been this way back to the Wallbangers, though, back in the day, too, I think, where
right.
You know, it's always been an entertaining team, nevertheless. So you're expecting to be entertained at the very least this year?
I think there's going to be a lot of runs scored on both sides.
opening day starters or the top of the rotation is looking like, and tell me if I'm wrong, Willie Peralta, Jimmy Nelson. Mm. And then Youngman, I'm not sure how to say that.
Youngman.
You're probably looking at those three guys at the top. Is that pretty close?
Yep.
And so, you know, Willie Peralta is intriguing if you don't watch him every day, I think.
Right.
Talk me down from viewing him as an interesting pitcher or build him up.
So I think right now he has zero secondary pitches that work. That's
okay,
that hurts. That's why he was awful last year. That's why he couldn't strike anybody out. He was also hurt. So, and I wouldn't be surprised if those two are related. 2 years ago, what you saw with him, the reason that I am excited about them giving him another chance and why, you know, he's only 26 and this is going nowhere. There's absolutely nothing to lose by sticking with this guy. He throws 95 mile an hour power sinker with huge run, and it's such a good pitch, but it's not a swing and miss pitch, and he needs just something, anything. He has a slider, but he can't throw for strikes right now. If he can just find something out of the zone that hitters have to be aware of, something that can keep them off balance, because if you're looking for anything else, that sinker is not hittable.
Right.
But since that's all that they're looking at, he gave up like a 30% line drive rate on it last year.
Oof, brutal.
He needs to have something to keep them off balance. And if he finds it, if he found it over the offseason, you know, I could see him being a solid middle of the rotation kind of guy. He's still, I don't think, good enough with that secondary stuff. I don't think there's any way to see him getting good enough with the secondary stuff to be an ace. But if he finds a slider or a curveball that he can get a few swings and misses with, yeah, that's a legit pitcher that can be on the next contending Brewers team.
So the Segura deal, if I'm not mistaken, Chase Anderson came over in that deal. Is that right?
Yep.
How How do you grade that deal? Obviously, you know, trades you can't grade immediately with a ton of accuracy. Mm-hmm. And so maybe, and especially this deal, you know, I'm a big fan of Isan Diaz. I think there'll be a chance that he can make that an A-plus trade for the Brewers in the long term. Mm-hmm. But in the near term, you know, are you expecting anything from Chase Anderson to move the needle forward?
Not particularly. I think if he turns out to be a fourth or fifth starter who can, you know, do that for 2 or 3 years, I think the Brewers would be pretty happy with it. Diaz is the player that made that deal worthwhile, of course. Second baseman, believe he won Pioneer League MVP last year. One of those, you know, minor league low level honors. Cause he just absolutely mashed. And I think, you know, that's what they need to do. They are accumulating a pretty good collection of prospects, a lot of whom have really great numbers. That's why the Fangraphs Cato system projected the Brewers as having the best farm system in baseball this year, mm-hmm. which I think is a bit over the top, but I think it's also revealing of the process that the new general manager, David Stearns, is going through with his trades. He's getting a lot of guys who might be undervalued for, you know, some reason or another, whether it's an attitude problem, that was the deal with Jonathan Villar, supposedly, or injuries, you know, guys like Reimer Liriano, or a guy like Diaz, who's just really far away from the majors, and the Diamondbacks were looking to go all in, so the Brewers plucked him. And so, yeah, I love those kinds of moves. Anderson, hard to see him being a great player, but, you know, the Brewers have had a horrible time developing pitchers in the last 10 years or so. Yovani Gallardo, really the only significant success story. So if they even get a placeholder out of it, that's pretty solid, because they don't have that right now.
Yeah, I agree with that. What are your hopes for Jimmy Nelson? That's a guy who I watched, you know, kept an eye on. I write a piece for Rotographs every week on Fridays for, you know, keeping an eye on guys who are making two starts the next week, you know, guys you can pick up and kind of exploit in fantasy. And there's a couple different weeks where he was interesting. Is he a guy for you in the future, or is he another one of those placeholder types?
No, he's really interesting because he has really, really good stuff. It's just a little raw at this point. And, you know, that was the reason why Nelson wasn't really so hyped up as a starter in the minors. There was a lot of talk about him becoming, you know, a closer setup type shutdown reliever because of how good his stuff is. And so there's still the question of whether or not he can really harness his command and control. But he had some really good stretches last year. I think he had a 15-start stretch where he had an ERA in the mid-twos. And, yeah, I think there's a lot for him to develop from at that point. He's only 25 or 26. He throws hard. He, unlike Peralta, he has flashed some pretty solid off-speed stuff. And that's, yeah, I think he could be a solid number two or number three.
Are you holding out similar hope for Youngman?
Youngman is more, I think, a number three or number four, because he doesn't have the quality of stuff, but I think Youngman's a lower ceiling, higher floor.
Okay.
Because he has better control. He's had a pretty developed repertoire ever since he came out of Texas. Gets a lot of ground balls, which is pretty important in Milwaukee. So hard to see him being an ace, but actually he does kind of remind me a lot of Yovani Gallardo in that sense, where Gallardo had to really nibble and was susceptible to home runs, but when his control was working, he was really hard to hit.
Do you... What exactly happened with Matt Garza last year? I mean, that was like a train wreck. And
he was pitching hurt.
Okay, and he, you know, he ended up getting sent home, unwilling to move to the bullpen. Do you have any, you know, it's not entirely different than Ricky Nolasco in Minnesota, where, you know, it's a veteran guy that, you know, the difference is the Brewers and where the Twins are in terms of their division is different. Mm-hmm. But is there any chance that he bounces back with an even decent year this year?
I'm not terribly optimistic, but I do think that his horrible numbers did have a lot to do with trying to pitch through pain. And Garza is one of those, you know, ridiculous tough guys who will, you know, he had to do it to be manly. So way to help the team, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really don't think throwing him in the bullpen for the last month or two of the season would have done anything. So I really don't have any problem with them sending him home and just saying, hey, you know, you're going to be around here for 2 years, or you have 2 years left on your contract, at least. Go get yourself right. Do whatever you need to do. Try and find whatever it was that made you a half-decent pitcher 2 years ago. And, yeah, I mean, Garza's been good enough, recent enough, that I think there's reason to believe that he could be okay again. You know, okay meaning something like, say, 3.5 to 4 ERA in 30 starts. You know, somebody could use that. Won't move the needle for the Brewers, but if he shows up and does that for 15 starts, maybe they can get, you know, a minor piece for him at the deadline.
The team rescued Zach Davies from the Orioles farm. And any pitcher that you take away from the Orioles farm would seem to be a rescue project. That's part of the Gerardo Parra deal. What do you know about him? Obviously, it looks like he's on the outside looking in for a rotation spot right now. But with the, you know, with the Matt Garza situation fluid, and that, you know, I think if they could move him, they would. Or if he shows anything and they can move him in the middle of the season, they'll do that. Is Davies a guy you're really excited about, or is he just another kind of back-end guy?
It's hard to see him being, again, it's hard to see any of these guys being the ace that would, like, lead a Brewers staff going forward. But Davies is another one of those guys where, you know, really solid minor league numbers. I think the reason that he was available for cheap is because he is skinny as a rail. Like, if you're looking at him from third base, you probably can't see him.
Oh, wow.
He's listed at 6 feet, 160. And,
woo.
You know, when you a lot of those listings on, like, Baseball Reference and all that, you know, you're getting the guys at the beginning of their career before they started lifting weight and putting on weight however they were doing it. Now, Davies is tiny. And so I think there's a lot of you know, he hasn't thrown more than 150 innings in the season. You've got, you know, the whole projectability issue. So, but yeah, he showed a really nice changeup last year. And I love the changeup. It's definitely a pitch you need, especially if you're not a high-velocity guy, which Davies isn't. So, you know, he could be a guy that could really, you know, thwart especially lineups that are built to platoon and be a solid mid-rotation starter if things go right. Again, you know, what I really like about what Stearns is doing is he's accumulating depth. All these guys, you know, if you're looking at it from the position of the general manager, you're seeing a whole lot of dice rolls. And the real way to make sure those dice rolls come up good for you is to get a lot of them. So,
are you gonna miss Chris Davis at all?
Oh yeah, yeah. I love his swing. It's so unorthodox. I've never seen anybody who swings like him. It looks so long. It looks like he should be striking out every time. But man, when he makes contact, it just goes. And his power is amazing. I think it was a really good deal for Oakland. I totally understand why the Brewers made that move. They needed to get Domingo Santana into the lineup every day, no matter what. And apparently they didn't feel comfortable putting him in center field, which I think makes sense. I don't think it would be great for his development to throw the new, tougher position at him while he's trying to learn how to not strike out 30% of the time against major league pitching in the True. First place, besides the fact that he's probably not physically capable of playing the position. So, it was a good deal that made a lot of sense for the Brewers to get rid of Davis, but yeah, I'm going to miss watching him play.
What's your excitement level for Santana? That's the next thing I was going to go to. It's kind of funny that you teased that.
He hit, you know, what I said about Davis having a long swing, and when he hits it, it goes far. Santana is longer swing and farther hits. The dude has so much raw power. It's really amazing. He's going to swing and miss a lot. He gives it, you know? He's not messing around out there. And I love that. So that's going to be really fun to watch. And it's a great park for him to do that in. So
who's going to be the closer if you choose, and how much will it actually matter?
I would choose Smith, Will Smith.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there's a little bit of an issue with him as a lefty who uses a slider, which is a big platoon split pitch. But he did a really good job against right-handed batters last year. And I think they have nothing really to lose by giving him a shot at it. Worst case, he's a solid left-handed setup man. You can still trade him for something worthwhile or keep him around. You know, I believe he's only in his first arbitration season. So there's a chance that he could be around for the next contending team, but I think they're probably going to look to deal him. Jeremy Jeffress is solid, but I think actually the issues with him facing, I don't think he has the out pitch that can get lefties out in the way that Smith's slider, which is just so nasty that it kind of overcomes the platoon split.
So you kind of got a perfect duo too, if you wanted to play matchups.
Totally, but I don't think that will happen just because, you know, if you're going to trade one of those relievers, the way to do that is to give them value by having a single closer, and also just like, you know, relievers like having set roles. And yeah. I think that matters.
Oh, yeah. I've been told by a number of different relievers that they prefer that. A couple former Twins in camp. Zach Jones, a reliever, Josmiel Pinto, who's not really a catcher anymore.
Right.
Do you hold out any hope for either of those guys on the roster? I know Jones has to make the roster or else be offered back to the Twins because he's a Rule 5 pick. Pinto's a non-roster guy. Are either of those guys showing anything that makes you think they can be part of the team?
I kind of doubt it. The Brewers have a ton of out-of-options guys. So both of them have a lot of players that they have to show that they're better than to win a spot, and I think it's pretty unlikely.
It looked like Pinto had decent spring training numbers, but you know, at this point, I don't know.
I mean, he's not going to play first base over Carter. He's not going to catch over Lucroy or Maldonado. So
yeah, and that's where it comes down to it for me. I don't know with concussions and that kind of thing if he's going to catch full time from now on, or if he's, you know, if he's got that Alex Avila thing where he's one knock away from just being done altogether.
Right.
You don't want to. You don't want to tempt fate when it comes to that kind of thing. So, you know, I thought that you'd probably splash a little cold water on that. I'm not terribly surprised.
Sure.
So with Jonathan Lucroy this season, are you anticipating him being moved by the deadline, you said?
Yeah.
What do you think is, you know, is it because his value has only up to go in the sense that he had such a rough year?
Yeah, and I don't think teams are going to be too worried about last year because there were injuries involved in that one again.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he comes out, it doesn't make sense to trade him right now because of that, for sure, because teams will want to see that he can return to form before they give up the kind of package that you need to trade a guy that's that good on that good of a contract. I believe he only makes a maximum of $6 million over the next 2 years.
Yeah, it's absurd.
Yeah. Yeah, they signed him to a very similar deal to what the Royals signed Sal Perez to. So, and I actually don't think they're that different of players either. They're both great defenders. They're both decent but not great hitters who get a lot of, you know, praise for their intangibles. So I think you'd need a huge package to get Perez away from the Royals at this point. So.
Yeah, I think so, especially with the extension signed, as far as Perez's
right
value in Kansas City. What would you have done differently in the offseason if you were the Brewers?
Oh, I actually really like the way they handled everything. They did a good job. They got prospects for guys like Adam Lynn, Chris Davis. They did a really good job, I think, with the Carlos Gomez trade with the Astros at the trade deadline last year, which was, you know, that would have been one of the big moves of the offseason this year, probably. So I kind of consider it part of the whole package. And so they've done a really good job just assembling a team of prospects.
Would you have preferred to get Zach Wheeler and Wilmer Flores?
No, I actually think the package that the Brewers got from the Astros is better. Brett Phillips is really exciting. Santana's exciting. And both of the pitchers that the Brewers got from the Astros have been making some waves. Josh Hader and Adrian Hauser. Hader, in particular, was the darling of the Arizona Fall League and was drawing some Chris Sale comps.
Wow. That I'm
going to cling to because the Brewers can't develop a starting pitcher, and so any sort of morsel like that, you know, just got to take it.
As far as a contention timeline, what do you think is reasonable for this team to get back to that level of competition?
So when I went on the Baseball Perspectives podcast, I basically said that I don't see a path to contention. They just have to get a prospect wave and get lucky. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to ask for a length of time, I say 3 years, which is partly influenced by how good the division is with the Cardinals and Cubs, and is also partially influenced by the fact that, you know, this team's bad, and a lot of the players that, you know, they're going to have to first get to the majors, then they're going to have to get good at the major league level. There's just so many steps that they have left to take that it's just really hard to project.
Couple throwaway topics before I let you go. Again, thanks for joining. I've been very glad to have you. What drew you to the Minneapolis area? You know, if people don't know, you live in the Twin Cities here. What drew you to the area specifically?
Oh, well, so I was living in Madison after college, and I decided that if I, you know, really wanted to pursue this career, I had to live in a major league city, and Minneapolis was the best fit for me in terms of, you know, it's pretty cheap here. Mm-hmm. I like that. I had people that I already knew. I had a friend of mine who was also going to move up here. So it was just right place at the right time. And I came up here also for the 2012 Sabre convention.
And
I
had great time.
And the city's beautiful. I really like it. So
you enjoyed it?
Yeah, I was already inclined towards it before all the other things that made it a good fit, you know, sort of fell into place.
And so we've taken in some Timberwolves and Twins games. What have your experiences been like at those? You know, obviously a little bit different with the Twins being not so great, but a great stadium, the Wolves being not so great with a lousy stadium. But have you enjoyed kind of like the sporting events you've taken in?
Yeah, totally. I love Target Field. It's absolutely beautiful. I've been enjoying a lot of very well-priced August and September games over the last few years, and it's been wonderful. That said, I think it's really going to be great when there's a contending team in Target Field and the fans can really get wild, because I really haven't been able to feel a whole lot of energy at a Twins game yet. And
oof, it's been horrible.
I think that would be a fun time. But any energy problem at the Twins game is multiple times worse at a Wolves game, because I just get the feeling that nobody cares about the Wolves here. And why would you? They've been awful for 25 years.
Is Carl Anthony Towns good enough to get you to renounce your Bucks fandom, to renounce it, or are you going to be Bucks forever?
I love the young Bucks right now with Adetokounmpo and Jabari Parker. Those guys are incredible. I'm pretty excited for what they're going to do going forward, even though this year was a disappointment. But yeah, gotta love what the Wolves are doing. Towns is incredible. I mean, I remember watching him last year at Kentucky. I thought he was really good, you know, inside force, good defense, but like, I did not expect to see him out there just draining threes like it's nothing. It's amazing how his outside game is just baffling. And he's 19, right?
I think he's just turned 20, but it's incredible too how when they moved Zach LaVine off point guard and been able to throw more minutes at Ricky Rubio as he's stayed healthy this year, it's opened up now. I think Rubio's hit like 40% of his threes over the last month, and LaVine's up in the mid-40s. You know, things are starting to open up. They're not playing any defense yet, and you know that whether they stick with Sam Mitchell or go with another coach could be a key point of contention to rally around. But it's a team that you have been able to watch come of age, and obviously played well last night offensively. Defensively was another story. But it's just been fun to watch them evolve, even if they've just been downright dreadful and at times can blow 10, 12, 15-point leads basically at the drop of a hat.
Yep, and that's part of being young, I think. Not only are these guys, you know, not terribly experienced yet, still learning their games, especially with a guy like Towns, you know, they're not even used to 48 minutes of 24-second shot clock. Yep. So
Let alone he was splitting time at center with, was it Cauley Stein last year?
Yep.
So I mean you that's why.
Yeah, Cauley Stein was the real defensive force on that team.
When you look at the minutes played by Towns as the season's gone on, it's also gone up. Yeah, each month, at least until I checked most recently, February. I haven't looked at March yet. But there was obviously a plan at play with getting him acclimated to the league. And whoever played the Timberwolves early in the season and not again should thank their lucky stars that they're not getting the Karl Anthony Towns that they're seeing right now.
Yeah, he's going to be a superstar.
He might already be close.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. Well, Jack, that's all I have for you. I wanted to say thanks again for coming on. Let us know, first of all, your Twitter handle. If I didn't give it earlier, I meant to. And then where we can find some of your work and keep up with it.
Yeah, I'm at JH_Moore on Twitter. And you can find me most often right now at Vocative, but also Hardball Times, Vice Sports, BP Milwaukee, and The Guardian. Those are the regular spots these days, at least.
Wow, so that's, you got plenty going on.
Yeah, the internet's Jack Moore, right?
Yeah, I think I said the same thing for Michael Bauman when I had him on before.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
that's good company to be in. That's one of the guys that I look up to and aspire
for sure,
to.
So, for sure.
Thanks again for joining us. You've been listening to Midwest Swing on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Catch us at Midwest Swing Pod on Twitter, at Cold Omaha MN on Twitter. Find us at coldomaha.com and coldomaha.com/Amazon for all your shopping needs. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next week.
Hey there, it's Sam Ekstrom, and I'm here to tell you that I'm not perfect. I have vices. Most of us do. Maybe you're like Peyton Manning and you enjoy Budweiser. Maybe you can't resist Dairy Queen blizzards. Maybe you're into e-cigs. Hey, no judgment. I enjoy betting on sports. And if you also enjoy betting on sports for a little entertainment, you'll love the podcast featuring yours truly, Sam Ekstrom, along with Sam Verhulst, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Available on iTunes and on Stitcher. Don't dread the spread. Turn your nickels into dimes.
Hey guys, this is Tom Schreier, co-founder of ColdOmaha.com. Thank you for listening to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and leave us a comment and a rating. Also, don't forget to check out ColdOmaha.com to see all of our podcasts and read articles about your favorite teams in the Twin Cities. If you have any suggestions or comments on anything related to Cold Omaha, email us at editors@ColdOmaha.com or follow us on Twitter at ColdOmahaMN.
The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.